The First Amendment to the Constitution protects speech no matter how offensive its content. Restrictions on speech by public colleges and universities amount to government censorship in violation of the Constitution. Such restrictions deprive students of their right to invite speech they wish to hear, debate speech with they disagree, and protest speech they find bigoted or offensive. An open society depends on liberal education, and the whole enterprise of liberal education is founded on the principle of free speech. The ACLU is clear about where it stands with regard to freedom of speech on college campuses, but those with opposing opinions, in specific cases in particular, are just as outspoken. We're going to delve into some court cases involving free speech on campuses. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at the UW-Madison, and welcome back to University of the Air.
Nice to be here.
The First Amendment. I wonder if the founding fathers had any idea how much ink would be spilled in the 200 and however many years to follow once they put that in the Constitution.
Actually, they likely did. I mean, let's keep in mind that the First Amendment, in addition to the Free Speech Clause, and the press clauses, freedom of the press, includes the religion clauses. And certainly the founding fathers, and especially James Madison, paid a great deal of attention to those issues. It's really an interesting bit of American constitutional history. Madison, during the 10 years between the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution, was deeply dismayed by the religious oppression that he saw in Virginia. The Anglican Church there did all sorts of terrible things to clergy from other churches and members of other churches. For example, there was a fine for anyone who wouldn't serve in the militia, which they went around and collected from Quakers. And in fact, the purpose of creating the fine was to raise money by extorting it from Quakers. There were ministers of non-Anglican churches thrown in jail, and various fairly awful things went on during that period of time. What most people don't realize is that in observing that situation, Madison came up with the idea that, well, if there were lots of religions, there wouldn't be a danger of one taking over. And that's the source of his whole theory of factions. I mean, almost Madison's most famous theory is the theory that as long as we have lots of small factions, no one will dominate. That's why a big republic is better. And he got that idea from religious pluralism. Free speech was also very well recognized as a highly contentious issue at the time, in the decades before, well, before the Revolution, certainly before the Constitution. So oddly enough, I think the answer might be yes. The founders likely would have not be shocked to know that we are still debating these issues to this day. They might be quite startled by the form the debates are taking, but that's a different story.
So free speech itself, the First Amendment, when we break it down, what is it saying about freedom of speech?
Right. And so the short – I mean, 3 points I like to try and make about the free speech clause that a lot of people don't understand. It's newer than you think. It doesn't mean what you think. And it's much more complicated than you think. So first of all, it's newer than people tend to think. And we just mentioned the founding fathers, but the fact is the free speech clause wasn't applied to the states until the 1920s.
Really?
So up until the 1920s, as far as the U.S. Supreme Court was concerned, states were perfectly free to throw you in jail for criticizing the governor or, for that matter, to put you in jail without a trial or any number of other things on the grounds that the rights in the Bill of Rights simply did not apply.
Did not apply. Why would they not apply?
Well, the understanding was that the Bill of Rights only limited Congress. So the First Amendment begins, Congress shall make no law. In fact, there's now a revisionist argument that goes to the effect that the, for example, the Establishment Clause that prevents Congress from establishing a religion was intended to preserve the ability of states to establish religions.
Oh.
That's a bit of revisionism. That's not certainly what Madison was thinking. But it does go to the point that up until the end of the Civil War and the adoption of the 14th Amendment, there are almost no provisions of the Constitution. There are very, very few that limited what states might do. And it wasn't until the 1920s, as I said, that for the first time courts began to think that the rights listed in the Bill of Rights might apply to the states. So in a very real way, we don't have 250 years of history of this debate. We're at the end of the first century, which is not a short period of time, but shorter than people think.
Notable instances that come to mind up to the point of 1920 when this was finally decided in a more concrete way?
Well, there are lots of controversies. So, for example, the first national more or less censorship law was a law making it a crime to mail abolitionist materials into southern states. There was also a rule prohibiting bringing up any abolitionist laws in Congress. Before that, of course, in the Adams administration, there was the Virginia, Kentucky and Virginia resolutions in response to the Alien and Sedition Acts that we all nicely remember. You know, that's another story, though, that isn't quite the way people might remember it. Jefferson and Madison come out strongly in favor of free expression and freedom of the press, except that Jefferson's point is not that expression should be free, it's that states rather than the federal government should silence it. And in his second inaugural address, he calls on states to shut down Federalist newspapers. So, yes, there are lots of controversial instances, but really the idea of a broad, sweeping right of freedom of expression that would be applicable across the board is modern, is a 20th century idea.
So it's really about states' rights up until that point.
Well, for some people. I will say that Madison was an exception. He genuinely believed in a principle of freedom of expression, and he wanted his original draft of the First Amendment to apply to the states from the very beginning. But for a lot of people, it was on the form of, you know, you can't beat up my little sister, only I can beat up my little sister kind of mentality.
So were there special cases once we get to the 1920s and,
sure.
You know, delegating this power in a more broad sense than just leaving it up to the states?
Right. So there's a whole, as is usually the situation, there's a bunch of cases all at once about a particular thing. In this case, it was World War I. And anarchists and socialists and other radical leftist types talking against the war, sometimes in really interesting ways. There was a guy who was sent to prison for distributing a leaflet at train station that said that the military draft violates the 13th Amendment because it's involuntary servitude, not for punishment of a crime. He had a point. It's not a mindless argument by any means. But this was an era in which states and the federal government both adopted sweeping anti-radical acts, anti-syndicalism acts, they were often called, for example, in California, and threw people in jail for being communists, essentially. And that practice persisted right up into the late 1950s. As late as 1952, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a conviction on the grounds that someone was essentially teaching and promoting sedition. It's really not, in fact, until 1969. So it's even a much more modern story than we think. It's in 1969 that there's finally a Supreme Court case, this time not involving communists, but involving the Klan, that says merely advocating something, like advocating the overthrow of the United States, or even advocating crime, is protected. It cannot be punished. It is protected by the First Amendment.
Even if we're talking about the violent overthrow of the United States?
As long as it's, quote, mere advocacy, end quote. Right? It's different if you're making a plan or you're instructing someone how or you're inciting them, but just saying it would be a good thing if in the future the United States were overthrown. You can't put someone in prison for that. But again, that's only in 1969. So free speech as a concept doesn't come into play until the 1920s, and there the famous phrase is fire in a crowded theater. States may punish speech that poses an imminent danger or tends to threaten national security. That was basically the mentality.
And this came before the Supreme Court in some form?
Oh, yes.
The fire in the crowded theater.
That's a great Oliver Wendell Holmes quotation,
yes,
certainly,
right.
From one of these cases from the 20s. So Holmes cites creates the clear and present danger test. And then subsequent courts apply that test very, very broadly. So I talked about the fact that as late as the 1950s, convictions of communists were upheld. And there's a famous line from Chief Justice Hughes where he says, you know, a small spark down the road might kindle a conflagration and we have to be able to stop it when it's still a spark.
That gives you a lot of latitude, doesn't it, in terms of prosecution?
A lot of latitude and is completely alien to our modern way of thinking about free speech. It's completely contrary to the basic core principles that we have nowadays. But those aren't really announced until the late 1960s and the war in court.
So things have turned around that much in the last 50-odd years?
Well, 1969 is 50 years ago. No, since 1969, the system in place has largely been consistent. And it wasn't just that one case. There were some other cases in the 1970s and earlier in the 60s that also strengthened the right of free speech. But that was the one that specifically prevented locking people in prison because you didn't like their political opinions.
Now, there have been, in terms of all kinds of other regulations, let's say, special cases mentioned.
Right. So the basic model from the 1960s forward, the one that we have today, has sort of two steps, if you want to think about it that way. First, there's a distinction between speech that is protected by the First Amendment and speech that is not protected by the First Amendment. It's sometimes called the categorical approach because there are these names of specific categories that are not protected. And the initial idea was that everything is protected except for a few specific things. The problem is that list has gotten very long. It actually really was from the very beginning. But just a few obvious examples. There's no theory of the free speech anywhere that protects my right to say, give me your wallet or I'll shoot you. Threats are not protected speech. Neither is blackmail. Neither is infringement on people's intellectual property rights. Neither is invasion of privacy or libel or trade libel, criticizing the goods people have for sale in their stores.
Really?
You can be sued for intentional infliction of emotional distress. Harassment is not protected. Selling nuclear secrets is not protected. There's an enormous range of actions performed by speaking or by writing that are not protected by the First Amendment. I'm just barely scratching the surface. One of the most interesting ones goes back to that question, you know, can you lock people up for advocating, hypothetically, the violent overthrow of the United States? And I said before the answer is no, you may not. But you may lock people up for inciting.
And this so there's is a category, some kind of like immediacy to it.
Right. So the test is an imminent danger of lawless action that's likely to occur. And there's all kinds of illustrations that law students love, right? I mean, if you're standing, there's a crowd in front of a building, and you yell, break the windows, that could be incitement for which you can be punished.
Kind of like, say, January 6th?
Kind of like January 6th, indeed. This is why this is a particularly, and on college campuses, this is also a category of speech that comes up with a relative frequency. On the other hand, if you're at a football game and you yell, kill the ref, that probably is not incitement because there is no likelihood that because you yelled that, people would take that action. If that action does occur, it probably wasn't because you yelled that message. So, yeah, the incitement category is one of those kind of open-ended categories. It doesn't have a content, right, the way threats. Threats names a particular content, speech that says I'm going to hurt you in a certain way. It isn't like that. It's more situational. It's the remaining bit of the clear and present danger idea that we still have with us. So the first question, though, you have to ask is the speech protected or unprotected? And there are different sets of rules for those. And as in everything else, it's more complicated. There's more or less protected speech. Let's keep it simple for the moment. For example, commercial speech, commercial advertising.
Where you can diss the competitor's product.
Well, no. I mean, if you do that and it's false, you can get sued for it. That's called trade libel. No, but the government can regulate, for example, false advertising. In ways that it cannot regulate lying and normal speech on the sidewalk. So commercial speech is called less protected. It's in the middle. But basically, we start out in the cases that we care about on a college campus, 99% of the time, we start out by asking, is this protected or unprotected? Now, the one that people bring up a lot is the idea that there must be an unprotected category called hate speech. Surely the government can punish hate speech.
Yes, comes up all the time.
And it's wrong. There is no such. And remember, these are categories of unprotected speech, right? It's the special categories for which you may be punished by the government.
And hate speech isn't in there.
Hate speech is not one of them. You may not be punished.
Define hate speech for us a little bit more, because it must be more than just saying I don't like ethnic group X because they're ugly and stupid.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's the next part of this point, which is that there is no unprotected category called hate speech, but an awful lot of what we mean by the phrase hate speech does fall into the category of threats or bullying or intimidation or harassment. So it's not that you can't regulate this expression we call hate speech. That's just not the name of a category. So, for example, if you're making rules for a university, if you make a rule that says any student who engages in hate speech, you know, will be sanctioned, that's an unconstitutional rule. But you're perfectly free to have rules that say students that engage in threats or students that engage in harassment or any number of other things, intimidation, you know, would be punished. And that covers a fair amount of what most people colloquially mean by hate speech.
Well, we're getting back to then coupling the word with the action.
Exactly. That's exactly right. There's a very famous phrase by a legal scholar named Mary Matsuda, words that wound. In fact, the original formulation of this idea that there are categories of unprotected speech comes from a Supreme Court case in 1946. And the phrase that the justice uses, I believe it was Murphy, is words that by their utterance inflict harm, so that's that words that hurt, or are no essential part to the discussion of ideas. We've never gone quite as far as to ban everything that's not an essential part to the discussion of ideas, but you get the idea of what they were groping toward in that situation. Obviously, most of the time on a college campus, no one has a big problem with saying colleges may punish students for engaging in blackmail or harassment. So the cases we care about are when colleges try to punish people for engaging in protected speech, the kind of speech the First Amendment does protect. And that includes, you know, America is a great country. You are an idiot for saying America is a great country. Anyone who says that is a communist. Anyone, and so on, right? Any kind of opinion, political, social, or otherwise, that's all protected as long as it doesn't fall into one of those categories.
The idea being that a college campus is a laboratory for ideas.
Well, that's where life gets complicated because, as I mentioned, there are different rules for unprotected and protected speech. So if we're talking about protected speech and an idea of how complicated this gets, look how long it's taken us to get to the point where most of the time we start the conversation, right? This is what we all assume we're talking about, but you have to sort of contextualize it a little bit. The rules have to do with what are called forums. And I can make this really simple. A classroom is not the same as Baskin Mall. Neither of those is the same as inside of a student's dorm room. We can make it even more complicated. The public spaces in dorms, the hallways in academic buildings versus faculty members' offices. Each of these is a different kind of space and has different kind of rules. So in the classroom, for example, it's immediately evident that academic freedom and freedom of speech become opposing values.
Yes.
Right? The geology department has no obligation to allow someone to teach classes and say the Earth is 4,000 years old and flat. They are perfectly within their rights to say, that's not what our department believes. When you teach that, we will fire you or not hire you in the first place. That's that notion of institutional academic freedom. The universities shape their curricula to teach what they think is education. And by the way, a different school is perfectly free to only hire geology professors who teach that the Earth is 4,000 years old and flat. The freedom cuts in all directions. But it's the freedom of the institution to define what's good teaching practice and what is the content that we want to present to students, which means that if you write a student writes on a paper that the American Revolution happened in 1812, I will mark that wrong. I'm a government actor, and I'm a government actor punishing this student for expression, sort of, I mean, in a way, right?
Yeah.
It goes much further than that. Universities are perfectly free, or they usually universities give this authority to departments, but it's the university that's acting, perfectly free to say, for example, in our political science department, we favor a certain set of theoretical approaches, and so we choose to hire people who do things the way that we like to do them. That's perfectly fine. The threat, traditionally, historically, and recognized by the courts, is when the government tries to tell colleges what they must or must not teach or whom they must or must not hire. So in the 1950s, it was, you must fire all communist professors.
Right.
A very famous instance involving the University of California system, which buckled and fired lots and lots of faculty members for suspicion of communist affiliations. Today, there's quite a lot of this.
Is there?
There are more than 50 laws in place or bills in front of state legislatures banning teaching or research on various subjects.
Well, if we get into – and I don't know if it's as much in the college level as it might be, say, elementary school, but the whole creationism versus evolution.
Well, there's that, although this is more about things like critical race theory, the attempt by state conservatives in state legislatures to push back against what they call the woke agenda. And in the pursuit of that, they have been quite willing to run roughshod over principles of freedom of expression and academic freedom in the college campus to a degree we have not seen things this widespread since the 1950s at least. And there's a certain irony here, right? Just a few years ago, we were all in a tizzy because college students were intolerant of free expression, and that was the great threat to free speech. And I must say, I never really bought that argument. There are 19.5 million college students in America. The fact that in a given year, a few hundred of them do something obnoxious is hardly surprising. And also, these are 19 and 20-year-olds. I don't really expect the most fully developed. I am much more concerned when the power of the government is used to prevent research taking place, to prevent teaching taking place, and to prevent colleges and universities from being able to decide how to fulfill their educational mission.
Does a carrot and a stick come into this at all when you talk about the government involvement, money available under certain circumstances?
Oh, absolutely, in all kinds of ways. So there have been efforts, including in Wisconsin, by the way, to link funding for the university to the defunding of specific programs, like here's your funding, but you may not use it for X, Y, or Z. Or to hold funding hostage unless the university in question or the college in question adopts policies that the legislature, you know, wants to see happen. There's quite a lot of that going on. I haven't even mentioned, for example, that more than 20 states have laws in place. And these aren't hypothetical. These are actual laws that say no one may do business with the state, including the public universities. This includes contractors, staff, and theoretically faculty No one may do any business with the state if they participate in the movement to boycott Israel because of its activities in the occupied territories.
This has actually been, put into action
in more than 20 states.
And this is a federal approach?
These are state laws.
This is
but they exist in more than 20.
20 different of them.
They've been challenged in court, but at the moment they're still on the books. That should be shocking, regardless of one's political view of the boycott and divestment movement. It's a long-standing principle that participation in a political boycott is freedom, is free expression. Right? So there's this it's a mark of the partisan times that we live in. Strangely, these efforts backed by the power of the state and federal government, mostly the state governments, to restrict academic freedom and freedom of expression get much less attention than what I think are the vastly less dangerous and vastly less consequential incidents that occasionally occur on a college campus when students disrupt a speaker or college administrators. And this certainly does happen. Wrongly punish students or try to punish students for engaging in free speech actions. And those are wrong. The ACLU is quite correct to point to those things, but I just don't find them nearly as serious as state governments having blanket rules that ban expression or ban areas of teaching.
A much bigger, broader, more powerful,
much more powerful
ongoing effect. We're going to look further at this often surprising phenomenon of free speech on campuses when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Howard Schwaber, and we're talking about the phenomenon of free speech on college campuses. And you said something, Howard, that I thought was intriguing. I never thought about it before. And that is the difference in various college spaces that would have a difference on freedom of speech.
Right. So this goes back to that basic model of what are the rules for the ways government, and one has to keep remembering, public universities are state government institutions. It doesn't feel this way, but I am the government of Wisconsin. That's a very strange thought. And I'm sure it's a very strange thought to the government of Wisconsin as well. What are the ways which government may regulate speech that is protected? And the answer is it depends where it occurs. So when it's in public, in what are called traditional public forums, and that's just a fancy way of saying places out in public people are accustomed to gathering. Think sidewalks, parks, the lawn in front of the Capitol, Bascom Mall, certainly, Library Mall, certainly, really obvious cases. In those kind of public spaces, the government isn't allowed to have rules that restrict the content of what you can say in any way. They are allowed to have what are called, there's always a fancy phrase, content-neutral time, place, and manner restrictions.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's a mouthful. But the original example really explains it perfectly well. And this goes back to, I don't remember the year. I'm going to say it's also from the 20s. If you've ever seen the movie Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, more than once.
There's a scene where they're walking across I think they're in Kansas, but this very flat plain. And from a long way away, you can see a truck coming closer. And as it gets closer and closer, this gubernatorial candidate on it with his campaign, these giant speakers blasting their message into the cornfields or the emptiness. And they watch it go by and disappear in the distance. It's a lovely and strangely wonderful scene. Those vehicles were called sound trucks. Mm-hmm. And before television and to an extent contemporaneous with radio, they were a way of getting messages, commercial messages.
Go up and down the street.
Up and down the street. And people would send these sound trucks into residential areas, which people living in the houses didn't necessarily like.
It wasn't quite the same as the Good Humor Man.
Wasn't quite the same. ice cream is so much more welcome than politics if you're sitting in your living room. I don't mind being reminded that there's the availability of ice cream. I resent being reminded of certain other things. So in one of the very early cases of this type, the Supreme Court said, yeah, you can prevent loud noises in residential areas. And the fact that someone is using these loud noises to express a political message doesn't change a thing. It's mm-hmm. still loud noise.
Like a muffler.
The key there, though, is that you're restricting the noise, not the message.
Right.
You couldn't say only Republicans may run sound trucks through the streets. That would be wrong. And it's very easy to see why. So neutrality is the key principle there. And it's a key principle in all of these discussions. So on Bascom Mall, for example, you could not say no one may discuss politics. But you could set a noise limit to amplification. You could have a rule saying no one can sleep there overnight if you wanted to. National parks have those rules.
Sure.
And people said, well, but we want to sleep overnight in a park as a protest. Isn't that different? He says, no, it's not. It's not about the message.
You've got to protest without sleeping over.
There actually was one of my favorites, Rock Against Racism, was a concert in Central Park in New York. And they wanted an exemption from the limits to how loud a concert would be on the grounds that they were serving a good cause. And the answer was, well, this might be a good cause, but that's got nothing to do with the fact that we can limit how loud you can be.
And what's a good cause would be a matter of opinion, too.
There is that as well. I think Rock Against Racism pretty obviously had a very specific viewpoint on a range of issues. So that's the easy one. And again, it's called public forums. So in a public forum, you simply cannot have rules that restrict what people can say. But you can have some rules that restrict how they say it. No yelling in people's faces. No invading personal spaces. There was a time, some controversial cases about whether cities could ban aggressive panhandling, for example.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like a good and some fine points.
Well, it did. But basically the answer is yes, you can. You can prevent people from approaching, invading personal space in ways that are unwelcome. The complicated cases are what are called limited forums. And this is one that's not unique to a university, but it occurs in universities more often than almost anywhere else. So this is what happens when the government creates a space that wasn't there before and invites members of the public to speak, which sounds very strange, but let me give you a couple examples. The easiest example is, I take it back. This one has been in the news quite a lot lately. School board meetings.
Yes, it has.
Yes, it has, right? And city council meetings. But school board meetings. School board meetings are often by rule, open to the public, and the public is allowed to comment. So that school board meeting wouldn't exist if the government hadn't called it. So in that sense, it's a space that wasn't there until the government created it.
Right.
And they've opened it to members of the public to speak. The rules there are the government is perfectly free to say you can only engage in relevant speech. You can't get up and explain why the Packers defense is terrible this year and take 15 minutes of time on a debate about text, right? You can't
probably wouldn't
that.
Take that long.
So it's perfectly okay to have content restrictions in that way. You have to talk about what we want to talk about because we call this meeting for a reason. But you can't have viewpoint restrictions. You can't say members of the public are free to come talk about the school bond issue, but only if they speak in favor of it, not if they speak against it. That
sure.
You cannot do. So in those situations, it's a different kind of neutrality that's at work. By the way, it's also perfectly okay to say only residents of the town may speak. There's all kinds of restrictions you can have. But always, the core principle is neutrality as to what is the position being expressed. If you scream, if you threaten, if you refuse to give the microphone, that gets back to the regulation of conduct. And they're perfectly free to have those rules. But they can't have a rule that says you can only speak favorably of the city council or anything like that.
Well, it may be a digression, but in instances, and I'm thinking of school boards or city councils, where somebody is recorded against their knowledge and then that is put out there
right.
To their discredit. Not exactly a free speech thing, is it?
It actually isn't. There's a separate – these are privacy laws, and different states have different laws about when you may record someone. So Wisconsin is what's called a one-party consent state, which means I can record you in a conversation without you knowing it because okay. I consented to do it because I'm the one doing it.
Good if you were wearing a wire.
For example, there's no rule against wearing a wire even mm-hmm. without the police having an author – even without a warrant or anything else. I can record our telephone conversations and say, hey, one of the parties, me, consented. On the other hand, if a third party tapped a phone line and recorded a conversation between you and me, that's a crime because neither of the parties to the conversation has consented. But that's really a different set of issues. Back to our limited forums, these show up on college campuses in a really interesting way. One that's specifically relevant to Wisconsin and a few other places, and frankly, not that many other places outside of Virginia, Berkeley, Wisconsin, and a couple others.
Really?
So ASM, Associated Students of Madison, we have a system in which the university gives students control over a pool of money, which can then be used for various things, including inviting speakers onto campus.
Yes.
The reason for that long buildup is it's not the university inviting the speaker to campus. It's the student group. And the student group in our system is independent of the university.
Interesting distinction.
Isn't it? So in the middle of the 1990s, 1995... Justice Kennedy said that pool of money is like a city council meeting. It's a limited – the money itself is a limited forum. It's a strange argument at first glance, but the idea is the university can say to the students, you may use this money to invite speakers. It cannot then tell them whom they may or may not invite, And the students have to use that money in a viewpoint-neutral fashion. They can't say we will only allow student groups to use this money to invite liberal speakers or secular speakers. So,
but who would be balancing that out?
Well, that gets very, very complicated. And in fact, the issue has gone to the U.S. Supreme Court, perhaps unsurprisingly. But as in Wisconsin, of course, ASM has a student judiciary and a finance committee, and they spend a lot of time worrying about these issues. And there are frequent court cases saying, you know, the student authorities refused to fund the speaker, or the activity I wanted to do, and this was wrong. And the whole theory of that, claim that the First Amendment is somehow violated if a student group isn't funded or a student group isn't able to bring in the speaker that it wants to bring in. That whole theory is specific to this idea of limited forums. It doesn't apply outside that situation. Limited forums show up in odd places. Here's another one that's, I think, not obvious. A high school. If a town allows its high school building to be used by the public after school hours for, say, social activities.
Common enough.
It is common. That's a limited forum. The town is not permitted. So, for example, the town is not permitted to say only secular activities may take place there. There's a specific line of cases. On that theory.
Aren't there? Really?
Well, on the theory that religion is a viewpoint, and therefore to say only secular activities may take place would discriminate against a religious viewpoint. Remember at the beginning I said it's newer and it's more complicated than people think. This is the more complicated part. Universities are unbelievably complicated because there are so many different kinds of spaces. People live at universities. People are employed at universities. People are students at universities.
And there are public spaces at universities.
And there are public spaces at universities. There are even members of the public who pass through public universities. And every possible configuration of policy concerns, legal rules, and constitutional principles appears somewhere on a university campus, which makes it awfully difficult. It's worth thinking, though, about what a friend of mine long ago called the danger of the tyranny of the loud. Imagine you were in a classroom and there was no rule that said you had to raise your hand to be called on. That wouldn't improve communication or discussion in that classroom. That would end it. If you could hear anybody at all, it would be only the loudest voices, and anybody else would be drowned out. This is essentially what the internet is, an utterly unregulated, unstructured form of discourse that therefore conveys nothing. Robert's Rules of Order are my favorite example. There are these incredibly complicated rules.
Right.
We have to take turns, and you have to speak on something that is salient to whatever's on the floor. And you know, anyone who's ever looked into these rules, if you're into games, it quickly becomes delightful just as a game, but is always struck by how extraordinarily complex they are. But the reason is that those rules make it possible to ensure all voices are heard. And without them, what you have is not hearing more voices. What you have is violence and chaos.
You have a sense that's a constitutional principle in terms of the First Amendment, that all voices should be heard?
Well, see, here's where things get problematic, because that what I just described, the danger of the tyranny of the loud, is something the courts have never recognized. In the context of education, so for example, a college classroom, there's been some recognition that there's a danger of disruption.
Right.
So high schools as well as colleges are allowed to make rules that would prevent disruption of the educational function. But that's not a very well-defined concept at all. And what would be disruptive or not disruptive is not at all easy to pin down.
For sure, yeah. I mean, because you might get into – two people might get into a perfectly valid debate about some principle that would take over the hour.
Right, exactly. Conversely, going back to a point I made earlier, a professor who wants to use – a lecture on the U.S. Constitution to talk about sports, right? We want the administration to be able to fire that professor.
Yes.
That's not good teaching. But none of these incredibly important considerations have any clear presence in First Amendment doctrine. And it's very, very hard to express them other than by kind of throwing up your hands and saying, well, you all know what I'm talking about. Which is not a very safe place to be in if you're relying on this.
Not from a legal sense.
No, indeed.
Maybe a sidebar here, but as long as we're talking about education and it being different in some ways, many ways, from the general application of these First Amendment principles, what about the difference between a college and high school or even an elementary school?
Sure. That's a great distinction to point to. Mostly elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools are treated the same. Anyone who is not an adult is a child. And that's not entirely true. There are some additional sensitivities for young children, but in general, they're treated one way and colleges are treated somewhat differently. So in secondary education and pre-secondary education, schools have an enormous amount of authority to regulate student speech. Schools can censor the student newspaper on the grounds that really it's the school's newspaper.
Is it this kind of like, is it the same as like in loco parentis that you hear about?
So in loco parentis was an old idea that actually did apply to colleges and universities back in the 60s. It said that when a student is at a college, the college is their parent.
And gets to tell them what to do.
Well, tell them what to do and shape their character and bring them up, so to speak. And that meant preventing them from saying obnoxious and offensive things. And the famous free speech movements at Berkeley were the protest movements of students that then spread across the country and got rid of the in loco parentis idea. Yeah, it is something like that. But it's also very much a sensitivity. There's a much greater sensitivity on courts' part to the risk of disruption in high schools than there is at colleges. So two students held up a banner at a parade. The vice president of the United States was passing through a town, and the school took all the students to go stand on the street and watch them go by. And two high school students unfurled a banner that said, "Bong hits for Jesus." Bong hits for baby Jesus, I believe it was. They were punished for doing so. And that punishment was upheld on the grounds that, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, schools are authorized or allowed, constitutionally permitted, public schools, to punish students for advocating conduct that would violate school policy, in this case, drug use. That doesn't pass the laugh test in an adult context. This was obviously parody. This is obviously humor. But when high schools are concerned, the fact is the courts allow very, very strict restrictions on student expression in one direction. Curiously, at the same time, they will not allow schools to have strong anti-harassment policies, stronger than those that are allowed in the workplace.
Where harassment must be very common.
Harassment is very common, and Justice Alito, for example, has written some very strong opinions on this point, where he says, oh no, we have to allow ordinary teasing to occur. We can't possibly punish, you know, sort of, it's really boys will be boys, if you'll pardon me phrasing it quite that way, and he did not use that phrase, but that's the summary that I take away.
So it's part of their maturation.
Something like that. But, you know, that puts you in a very odd and uncomfortable
place.
Yes,
it does.
And if you apply those same rules to colleges, and there certainly, which certainly has been done, that is, colleges have tried to have what are sometimes called speech codes that get struck down. And in some instances, the courts are preventing colleges from punishing speech that in a workplace would be harassment. So we are telling college students they are required to tolerate levels of harassment that they will never have to tolerate. Once they're out of college and in the workplace, what's the price of receiving an education?
Is that the distinction that's made?
No, the distinction that's it's very hard to explain what the distinction is that's made. Other than there is a notion that freedom of expression on college campuses is particularly important, and there's a suspicion. I think courts are deeply suspicious of university administrators. I think that's really what's going on here.
Of the administrators. We're going to look further at some of these surprising instances of free speech on campuses and how it spills over into other areas of life when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Howard Schwaber. We're talking about free speech on college campuses, a complicated, ongoing issue, as it turns out. And that includes, as we've touched on earlier, Howard, hate speech and this whole image of a university is a place where you're supposed to share all kinds of ideas, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and all that kind of thing. So what about hate speech?
Dialectic.
Yeah, right. What defines it?
Right. So this gets extraordinarily complicated. And again, first caveat, some kinds of speech are simply not protected. And if you go around engaging in threats or harassment, you can and should be punished for that. And the First Amendment has nothing to say to protect you in that situation. It gets really complicated, though, in the sense that on the one hand, universities are not neutral institutions. They're purpose-driven. There's an educational mission. And as I said earlier, as we talked about earlier, academic freedom is the idea that universities are free to design the environment and the policies and the activities in a way that furthers that educational mission. Well, one strong part of an educational mission is that everyone should feel safe and everyone should feel welcome. It is not at all hard to make an argument, and there's plenty of evidence to show that students who feel unsafe or unwelcome don't learn as well. So from the university's perspective, there's a really powerful mandate to try and
safe.
Safe certainly
makes sense, but welcome, that's a more subjective thing, isn't it?
Well, there's a lot. It is certainly subjective, and then one of the problems here is that trying to make policy to make students feel welcome is a very squishy, if I can use that word, area, and very hard to quantify. But there's all kinds of evidence that shows students feel that they don't belong, or that the university doesn't believe they belong there, or that their fellow students don't believe that they belong there.
And they're very, I think, at that age, vulnerable to that kind
they are,
of feeling
they are
anyway.
Very vulnerable. And listeners will recognize these are the kind of studies that come in the context of things like affirmative action. If students don't feel like the institution welcomes them, or their peers, or their teachers, you know, think they belong there, that has a really harmful effect on educational attainment, which should surprise no one. Conversely, though, let's take a different example. Nowadays, we hear quite a lot of hand-wringing. I don't mean to be dismissive, but a little bit dismissive. Hand-wringing over the idea that perhaps conservative students don't feel that their views are welcome on campus, and other students have a First Amendment obligation to make them feel that their ideas are welcome. And that's, from a First Amendment perspective, complete nonsense. No one has the right to – you have a right to speak. You don't have a right to feel welcome for your speech. In fact, the people who say to you, your ideas are terrible and you're a terrible person for thinking that, they're exercising their free speech rights. And to say you may not make anyone feel that their ideas are unwelcome would itself be an infringement on the First Amendment. It would be a viewpoint restriction. That's impermissible.
Makes sense.
Well, in a university, these two things point in opposite directions. On the one hand, you might want to say no one should tell another student that their values or their beliefs – I mean, never mind their personal characteristics. Perhaps you want to say no one should tell another student that their opinions, their values, or their beliefs are immoral or stupid or destructive or bad. And you could see why you might want to have something like that. So you don't have people saying, oh, you're a Christian? That means you're an ignorant fool and servant of evil. Because that's not
– it's not nice, but is it
– it's more than not
isn't
nice.
Isn't it really your – it's not your right to say that?
Oh, no, it is your legal right, but you might wish we were able to stop it.
Sure.
It's absolutely your legal, your First Amendment right to say that. But from an educational perspective, that's not the kind of discourse
right.
that makes for a college campus where learning happens effectively. Education is all about dialogue and discourse. And not all discourse is equally valuable in that regard.
And that, yes, that's true. I can see what you mean there because remarks like that, your religion is, you know, stupid, you're ignorant and all that, is more likely to shut down dialogue
Absolutely.
Than to encourage it.
Absolutely. It's speech that silences speech rather than the other way around. And you can imagine this in a classroom setting. You can imagine this coming from a faculty member. Now, I've said this before, but I'll reiterate it because I feel very strongly about it. If a faculty member engages in that kind of expression, that's just bad professional conduct and that person should be fired. I will confess there's a recent court case that I find simply baffling. And all I can do is tell you that I find it baffling. And this is the case of a college professor who refused to abide by his school's policy of calling students by their preferred gender pronouns. And he said that violated his free speech rights and his religious freedom rights, and the court sided with him, and I don't understand it because a school is absolutely able to say, be nice to your students because we think being nice is good teaching. And if your religion prohibits you from being nice to students, you're in the wrong profession. I'm simply baffled by that particular outcome, and all I can say is it reflects the politics of our time. But the general principle, right, is this problem that the very things that might make students feel unwelcome or even unsafe in – I mean, some students are sensitive. So unwelcome or even unsafe in ways that infringe on their education might be First Amendment-protected expression. And that
Sure.
creates this tension that we're constantly trying to navigate.
Well, let's get into some broader phenomena then that are more apparent, and that would be protests and the nature of protests that which could certainly make a student feel unwelcome, public protest.
Certainly. So again, something that's been much in the news, not as much as 3 or 4 years ago, but there have been a couple of incidents quite recently, so it's sort of back. Marquette has had an incident just this past – I believe it was just last week – in which some student leaders who are students of color engaged in a protest that disrupted a freshman orientation event. All right, question, what's the First Amendment status of that?
Good question.
And the answer is, on the one hand, really simple, but in practice, as always, much harder to figure out the specific lines. There is no First Amendment right to exercise what is called the heckler's veto. So if someone is speaking on a speech on a street corner, I have a right to stand 3 or 4 feet away and say a different opinion. I don't have a right to shout so that she cannot be heard. To silence. That's that speech that silences speech, the tyranny of the loud and all of that.
And now it could apply to a protest.
Well, so one thing that arises frequently is that student groups will invite speakers who are unwelcome. Often this is, frankly, done provocatively in order to invite a speaker that the other students will find unwelcome. The other students, you know, perhaps rise to the bait and organize a protest. That's fine. But if that protest takes the form of disrupting the speech, preventing the speaker from being heard, preventing the student group that invited that speaker from having their event, that's no longer First Amendment protected. In fact, on the contrary, there's an obligation on the part of the university authorities to prevent that from happening and to punish it when it does, because the heckler's veto is content neutral. It can be used to silence liberal speakers and conservative speakers, progressive speakers and radical speakers.
So it's to everyone's advantage to prevent or punish a heckler's veto.
It's more than an advantage. It's essential to maintaining a free speech environment. Particularly in a college campus, which, again, is unlike many other places in that there are a lot of people with very many different backgrounds all lumped together in one place. There are very few other contexts. If you think about the students, the staff, the faculty, the administration, the visitors on a college campus, that's an extraordinary range of backgrounds
and opinions
and personal histories and opinions. And it's also just a lot of people in one place. There's something like 40,000 people altogether at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Very few institutions have that many that are not part of the military have that many people in one place at one time. So it's essential to prevent the heckler's veto. And a student expresses an opinion. Another set of students protest it. Counter-protesters protest the protesters. Counter-counter-protesters protest. That's fine ad infinitum. And it is the job of the university and the university law enforcement to ensure that each one of those protests is able to occur as long as it's peaceful. But as soon as one group tries to prevent the other group from being able to express themselves, again, assuming we're talking about protected expression, not threats or incitement to violence, then the system is broken down.
What's the outcome in terms of something like the internet?
The internet is a free speech nightmare, frankly, in many senses. One, it's a bit of a cesspool much of the time, but also in the case that it just poses problems for which our current understanding of the First Amendment are just completely completely inadequate. We have no categories that are suitable and appropriate for this. So, for example, we talked about spaces. Classrooms are different from lawn. A classroom is different from basketball. All true. What kind of space is the internet? What kind of forum is that? And the answer is, I have no idea. There are a couple of states that are trying right now to make laws to require organizations like Facebook to allow speech that they want to ban.
I was wondering about Facebook.
A case out of Texas is about to go to the Supreme Court because a case in Florida from the 11th Circuit has struck down one of those laws. So the short version is the Supreme Court will be addressing those laws, I think, in this coming term. The easy but very partial answer, and it's a very partial answer, is if you couldn't do it in real life, you have no right to do it on the internet. Threatening people, harassing people, blackmailing people doesn't suddenly become magically protected speech just because it takes place in cyberspace.
If I'm a student or maybe even a faculty member or an administrator, what are my rights in terms of what I can say on Facebook or any other internet forum? What recourse would the university have if they found that what I was saying was at odds with their mission?
Properly speaking, none. Whatever space the internet is, it's not a space that falls within the jurisdiction of the university itself. That being said, not all rules are spatial. Some of them are content-based. So if you use the internet to harass a fellow student, the standard at UW-Madison is in a way that substantially interferes with that student's ability to pursue their education, yes, you are certainly properly subject to punishment. If you use the internet with the intent of and with the effect of somehow disrupting the operations of the university, sure, that's not protected. But as long as what you're expressing is opinion, is judgment, is personal thoughts, is the full range of possibilities, as long as what you're expressing is something you have a right to say standing on Bascom Mall, the university has absolutely no special authority to restrict what you say just because you're on the internet. And that goes for faculty just as much as it goes for students. Faculty do have free speech rights to express themselves outside their professional role because, it's not The university has – I've been emphasizing one side of the equation, but not the other. I've been emphasizing the idea that the university has a legitimate role
to control speech.
Well, teaching and professional performance of duties and so on. But the university, conversely, has no legitimate role in restricting what a faculty member expresses when they're not, so to speak, on duty. And that's where the internet comes in.
Have cases come up? Do you know?
They have. There was a guy who was fired from – I'm sorry, I didn't look this up before I came in, but I believe it was UW-Milwaukee. This is about 3 years ago or 4 years – no, a bit more, 5 or 6 years ago. He was an adjunct. He was not a tenured faculty member, which shouldn't matter, but in the real world does.
Tenure, yeah, that's a big thing.
That's a big thing. That's a whole, and it's worth noting, tenure exists for First Amendment purposes as well, to preserve the freedom of faculty members to engage in research that might be unpopular or that the government might not like. That's why there's tenure.
To protect them from immediate dismissal for some perceived infraction.
Well, not to protect their free speech rights to pursue research.
Specifically for that.
That the government might not want them to be doing.
Really?
So if I want to do research that explores – oh, I'm perfect, critical race theory. The theory of tenure is I'm protected in my ability to conduct that research even if the government doesn't like it.
In this case in Milwaukee then, how did it play out?
So this was a guy who didn't have tenure. He went on the radio and said some things about the 9/11 was a put-up job and it was a fake. He was a 9/11 truther. But no one suggested any of that had ever entered into his teaching or his interactions with students. The university fired him. They were forced to take that back because they had acted wrongly. They had no legitimate purpose in controlling what he said when he wasn't engaged in his duties as an employee of the university. And that's a general principle. And the same thing goes with being a student. So one of the spaces we haven't talked about is dorms. When you're in your dorm room, the university has absolutely no authority to limit how you express yourself as long as it's not criminal.
What if it's in a public area in a dorm, though?
That's more complicated. That gets very complicated. And there's no good, clear answer. For example, should the residents of a dorm be allowed to say, this is our collective home, so it's a private space, it's what's called a private forum. The so-called public areas are really more like the living room in a house. Therefore, we should be allowed to say we will not tolerate, for example, racist speech in the public areas of our dorm. That's one way to look at it. Another is, well, this is university property. The public spaces are open. Anybody can walk into a dorm building, into the public spaces. The students don't have the authority to lock the doors and keep everybody out, so it's not private in that sense. Therefore, it's a public forum. Therefore, you can't have any restrictions on content. I have no good answer other than to say that's extraordinarily difficult. And it shows how badly these categories of spaces map onto the actual experience of running a university.
And that's why we'll continue to see these cases come up, I imagine.
Indefinitely.
Having to do with free speech on college campuses. Howard Schwaber, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great talking with you and hearing from you. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.